Manito Trail, and many made long-lasting impressions on aspen trees. As Amanda Castaneda with the Wyoming State Historic Preservation Office explains, these arbor glyphs were created with sharp tools carving thin lines that would expand as the trees grew. Many were straightforward, featuring family names or dates.
But you're also seeing some really beautiful drawings, a lot of religious imagery, glamorous women with 40s and 50s style haircuts. So you can come across some pretty striking artistic accomplishments in the forest.
Workers and their family settled in segregated Laramie's west side, the south side of Cheyenne, the South Park Barrio of Riverton, and the south side of Rawlins, where residents still maintain traditions from their home region. Martinez says many of her students are surprised to learn that their direct ancestors traveled the Manito Trail.
They go home and they ask questions. They call their grandparents to learn more. When students explore their communities and histories, they affirm their connection to ancestral knowledge and life-producing energies.
This is Eric Galatis.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 21st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Galatis and Tramel Gomes. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. All our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, featuring the Global Citizen International Digest.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Elon Musk denied the Ukraine army use of Starlink. India's deteriorating democracy. Torture in Ukraine is Russian state policy. First, Elon Musk and Starlink. Listeners may recall my report a month ago on the extraordinary power Elon Musk wields over satellite communications. Starlink, made by Musk's SpaceX company, is crucial for internet access by several developing countries and by military forces, including the U.S. military. As the New York Times has reported, quote, today, more than 4,500 Starlink satellites are in the skies, accounting for more than 50% of all active satellites. They have already started changing the complexion of the night sky, even before accounting for Mr. Musk's plans to have as many as 42,000 satellites in orbit in the coming years, unquote. I reported that Musk's friendly ties with Russia may lead him to deny use of Starlink to Ukraine military commanders. Sure enough, we now have reports that he did so, thanks to a forthcoming biography of Musk by Walter Isaacson. He notes that Musk, who had been very generous in providing immediate Starlink service to Ukraine when Russia first invaded, ordered a stop to the Ukraine military's internet service when Ukraine was preparing a drone strike on the Russian fleet based in Sevastopol, Crimea. Isaacson acknowledged that he had mistakenly written that Musk issued the order last September, when actually it was a standing order early in the war out of fear, Musk says, that the Ukraine strike would set off a nuclear counterattack by Russia. This concern arose out of a conversation Musk says he had with a top Russian general. As Musk should have known, the general naturally exaggerated the consequences to get Musk to deny Ukraine access to Starlink. An advisor to President Zelensky of Ukraine said the actual result of Musk's interference, quote, was that civilians, children, are being killed. This is the price of a cocktail of ignorance and Musk's big ego, unquote. No wonder various governments, including the U.S., are now discussing how to rein in Elon Musk's power over wartime communications. India's deteriorating democracy. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is fast becoming a global influencer, as evidenced by India's recent hosting of the G20 major economies and its space explorations. But India's democracy is an entirely different matter. Modi is a Hindu nationalist, another illiberal populist who has taken aim at the country's Muslim minority. A former Indian Supreme Court Justice, B.N. Sri Krishna, interviewed by a prominent Indian journalist, offers an unvarnished look into the present and future of democracy in India and constitutional rule. Given our own struggles with preserving democracy, this jurist's comments are worth our attention. Justice Sri Krishna said, quote, "A kind of madness is prevailing today in India. Passions are running high. A fire is burning. If you keep on fueling it, it will burn. If you stop fueling it, one day it will slowly subside and die out." How to stop it? Quote, "The average person in India has not realized that this is not merely a question of somebody being attacked on the basis of religion. It is a question of constitutional rights. My constitutional rights can also be taken away in the same manner. I feel that this is the work of idiots who do not understand the basics of the Hindu faith, who claim to be Hindus without understanding the basic values of Hinduism. There is an atmosphere of fear," he continues, "the fear that if I were to publicly voice my views, I might be subjected to harassment. That is the thing that drives the ordinary citizen and his feelings underground. As long as I am untouched, let me be happy. Let me not get involved in all of these problems," unquote. The justice puts his faith in the Supreme Court and in God. Quote, "I am also glad that the Supreme Court of India has come out very strongly against hate speech. It's acting in a manner that is completely consistent with constitutional values. I know God will put an end to this nonsense. Anytime Dharma is deteriorating, God promised he will create somebody who will be able to confront it. That is the promise that the Bhagavad Gita makes. That is the promise that the Torah makes to the Jews. And I'm sure the Quran also makes that promise. That is a promise I believe in," unquote. Then he goes on, "Unless the state is complicit in it, these things won't continue. But the state is complicit in it. What can you and I do? We can't reason with the state. We are not in a position to stop it by merely lecturing. The state is not going to listen to us. For them, gathering votes is more important than trying to look at constitutional values," unquote. A recent Council on Foreign Relations report on U.S.-India relations concluded that there will be no formal alliance between the two countries. That stands to reason considering India's stance on the Ukraine war. The report's author emphasizes India's independence, its freedom of action, as he puts it, which would be constrained by an alliance. But why no mention of India's deteriorating democracy? President Biden supposedly hinges U.S. foreign policy on the democracy versus autocracy framework, which would make closeness to India undesirable. Yet, undemocratic rule in India doesn't seem to be a factor for Washington, whereas technological and military cooperation does. What a surprise. Torture in Ukraine is Russian state policy. Alice Jill Edwards, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, spent 7 days in Ukraine interviewing people who had witnessed torture by Russian forces. She confirmed this consistent pattern of torture, including rape and beatings, in different detention facilities under Russian occupation and among Ukrainian soldiers captured by Russian forces. Quote, "This is not random, aberrant behavior," she said. "This is orchestrated as part of state policy to intimidate, instill fear, or punish, to extract information and confessions," unquote. Her various attempts to engage the Russians on the issue drew blanks, indicating to her that in fact the Russians are aware of and approve of torture. Quote, "They deny they do it, but show me the military directive where torture is prohibited." In other news, the painful process of evasion on Ukraine. How not to make a meaningful statement on the war in Ukraine was on display at the recently concluded G20 summit in India. Whereas a year earlier, the same group had condemned Russian aggression, this time around it struggled to come up with something rather than nothing. A CNN insider's report says it took 200 hours and 15 drafts to come up with a final declaration that said such things as, quote, all states must act in a manner consistent with purposes and principles of the UN Charter, or all states must refrain from threat or use of force to seek territorial acquisition against territorial integrity and sovereignty, or the use or threat of use of nuclear weapons is inadmissible, or there were different views and assessments of the situation, or today's era must not be of war. Ukraine had the final word, saying the document was, quote, nothing to be proud of. And speaking of evasion, the recently concluded summit meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, failed to condemn the brutal rule of the military in Myanmar, Burma, where the civil war now claims at least 4,000 dead and 20,000 civilians imprisoned for opposing the junta. To be sure, the final ASEAN statement blamed the military for, quote, continued acts of violence that include deliberate attacks on civilian targets and public facilities. But its call for the parties in the civil war to engage in constructive dialogue reflected not just a lack of consensus in the group, but also its irrelevance in the face of horrific violence by the junta. No wonder the junta, which did not attend the summit, reacted dismissively, probably for two reasons. It has China's support, as do other ASEAN members, and it faces no economic consequences, such as sanctions, for its criminal actions. Attendance matters. The 10-nation ASEAN group held a summit in Jakarta, Indonesia, around the same time as the G20 meeting in India. Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin were noticeable no-shows in New Delhi, and President Biden was a no-show in Jakarta. Vice President Kamala Harris took his place. She brought promises, a $1.2 billion budget request to Congress for Southeast Asian economic development and security assistance. But attendance by national leaders counts. A former Thai foreign minister said, quote, while Harris's presence is a welcome gesture, Biden's would be, quote, a demonstration of U.S. keen and genuine interest for U.S.-ASEAN relations, unquote. But Biden had other travel plans, to India and then to Vietnam. Too bad, because Biden missed a chance to weigh in on a major ASEAN concern, being forced once again, as during the Cold War, to take sides in the U.S.-China competition. Indonesia's President Joko Widodo told attendees at the ASEAN summit that the group must steer clear of worsening U.S.-China friction. Quote, ASEAN has agreed to not be a proxy to any powers. Don't turn our ship into an arena for rivalry that is destructive. He said this at a speech at the opening of the ASEAN summit. What he didn't acknowledge is that being caught in the middle also provides opportunities to play both sides. For example, Vietnam getting technological help from the U.S. and secretly buying weapons from Russia, or Thailand receiving U.S. security assistance while also seeking better relations with China. It's all in the game. The latest global warming report card. U.S. and South African scientists have composed a two-year report card called a global stocktaking on how voluntary efforts by governments to combat climate change over the last 2 years have worked out. Not surprisingly, little has changed to keep the planet from reaching 2.5 degrees Celsius by 2100, meaning a future characterized by more droughts, wildfires, hurricanes, and loss of coral reef and fish. As Ani Dasgupta, president of the World Resources Institute, puts it, quote, the United Nations polite prose glosses over what is truly a damning report card for global climate efforts. Carbon emissions, still climbing. Rich countries' finance commitments, delinquent. Adaptation support, lagging woefully behind, unquote. One piece of good news, the Biden administration announced a major reversal of Trump-era regulations to protect the oil and gas industry's investments in Alaska. The administration will prohibit drilling in 13 million acres of pristine wilderness in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska and cancel drilling leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The next global stocktaking will occur at COP28 in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Kim Jong-un's Russia trip concludes. Last week, I reported on Comrade Kim's arrival by train in Vladivostok to do business, mainly on weapons. His entire trip was taken up with visits to military facilities. As a result, Russia is likely to provide North Korea with nuclear and missile help, notwithstanding UN sanctions on the North's ballistic missile tests. Russia may also provide food assistance to offset North Korea's always troubled agricultural sector, and it may increase the number of workers it sends to North Korea. North Korea is likely to provide Russia with a variety of weapons, including multiple rocket launchers, artillery shells, sniper rifles, drones, and missiles. Kim also used the occasion to reiterate support of Russia's war on Ukraine, saying, for instance, that Russia would, quote, win a great victory in the sacred struggle to punish the band of evil that aspires to hegemony and feeds on expansionist illusions, unquote. Finally, Biden on China. The president confided that he had indeed met with China's premier Li Qiang at the G20 summit in New Delhi. That's the summit Xi Jinping decided not to attend. Biden said the meeting was, quote, not confrontational at all. We talked about stability. We're not looking to hurt China, Biden said in Hanoi, where the U.S. and Vietnam upgraded their bilateral relationship. Biden pointed to China's high youth unemployment as one policy challenge facing Xi. He might also have mentioned the disappearance of China's defense minister, General Li Shangfu, part of an ongoing reshuffling, or maybe a purge, of the People's Liberation Army. This is not a criticism, he said. It's an observation. Xi has his hands full right now. The president might have added that so does he, proving once again that foreign policy begins at home. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks very much for listening. Take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. American historian Charles Beard is primarily known for his most influential book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. But he wrote a great deal more than that, including works on U.S. foreign policy. Richard Drake is a history professor at the University of Montana who's written quite a bit about Beard. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking him how he became interested in Beard's work.
I actually read Beard in college many, many decades ago, and was quite taken with his book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, which appeared in 1913. And it surprised me when I went to graduate school how little support his ideas, his economic interpretation of history, had from the professors I was encountering in graduate seminars. And that really struck me with great force. And I just continued to read Beard's work through the years and decided that he had a great deal to say, not only about American history, but his ideas concerning the American present. His books were very prophetic, I thought. And I wanted to write a book about him and try to bring back his legacy to the attention of the American people and see if he might be able to help us out of some of the crises that we face today.
So you think his interpretation was regarded by many in academia as too simplistic, too reductionist, and not willing to consider other factors and not giving, say, if you're talking about the Constitution, not giving the Founding Fathers credit for their mm-hmm. ideas about limited government, checks and balances, division of powers, etc.?
Well, he certainly had a high opinion of the intelligence and the learning of the Founding Fathers. The 1913 book and subsequent books that he wrote are very complimentary about them in terms of their intellectual abilities and their general cultural sophistication. But he also thought that, as with all political figures, which the Founding Fathers were, they represented economic interests in society, and he sought to show just how controlling those economic interests were in 1787 at the time of the Constitutional Convention, and how influential the Constitution has been ever since in promoting and protecting the economic interests of the country's elites. I think that's a very important point for us to understand about not only American history, but about the way the country is run today. I think his insights are as applicable, if not more so, in understanding what's going on in America in 2023 than they were when he wrote his book in 1913.
And when you get to World War II, do you think his dismissal by some of his intellectual colleagues was because of the position he took on the war?
I think his position on the war was misunderstood. To begin with, Beard was a fierce critic of the Nazis. He condemned them from the beginning for their anti-Semitism, for their obsession with racial hygiene in their educational system. He wrote extensively and very critically about the Nazis and always was a fierce adversary of them. But he did not think that America went to war in 1941 primarily to defeat the Nazis. He thought that was incidental to the real objectives of the United States government in 1941. The real objectives were to establish an American economic hegemony in the world. And he thought that was an extremely dangerous objective and a policy that would have the United States at eternal war from that point forward. And I think that was a very prophetic statement that he made. We've been at war constantly since 1941, and essentially for the same reasons in each case, as Beard predicted, to protect and augment the corporate capitalist system, not to promote democracy, not to promote human rights or liberty or any of that. Those are all rhetorical flourishes in his estimation, designed to camouflage the economic objectives of the American warfare state.
Bringing it up to today, we see that Russia and China have been critical of the U.S. for what they say the U.S. is trying to do, that is establish hegemony over the entire planet. Do you think that's something that would go along with what you just said, that that's what Beard predicted?
I think Beard would say that really beginning with the Bretton Woods Financial Conference of July 1944, when the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were created, that the American economic hegemony has been a fact of life in the world. It's not a question of trying to impose American economic hegemony. That hegemony exists. And one of the objectives of American wars from 1945 on, the Korean War, Vietnam, the others coming right up to our own time, is to promote, to defend, and to augment the American economic system, the American economic hegemony. And Beard thought this was a path, as he put it in one of his books, that would lead to perennial war for perennial peace. We would never stop being engaged in these wars to protect an economic system that, in his opinion, or he was arguing from a culturally conservative standpoint. He was certainly not a Marxist. He was not a socialist. He was really inspired by a conservative thinker, John Ruskin, a famous art historian and social critic, was very severely critical of the corporate capitalist system as a means to enrich economic elites, but to leave the vast majority of people on earth poor and exploited. And Beard accepted that idea. And he thought we really need to change our system of economics. We need to make it much more democratic. We need to be aiming at the betterment of the population at large. We need to take care of the underlying masses and not be focused, as we have been, on promoting the economic betterment of the tycoons, which is what he thought was going on in America. I think he was right.
Well, you do have, or you have had opposition to that, both within countries from various social protest movements, but also from during the Cold War period, the Eastern Bloc. There was the non-aligned nations as well, and now you have the BRICS nations, and
right.
There is some opposition. I mean, it's not a totally unipolar world, would you say?
I think the opposition to the American hegemony, the corporate capitalist hegemony, is really gathering momentum and strength. I think it would be in our interest to try to participate in that reform movement, to become active agents in trying to guide it toward democratic, egalitarian ends. That seems to me to be the rational way to proceed, not only for economic reasons, but for environmental reasons. The existing economic system that we have in place, producing the consumer society that is endangering the planet, requires change. It requires revision. It requires revision along the democratic and egalitarian lines that historians like Charles Beard and his principal intellectual heir, William Appleton Williams, a great historian at the University of Wisconsin, other writers such as Gabriel Kolko, another outstanding revisionist historian. These intellectuals and scholars, I think, have provided us with a scintillating intellectual legacy that will help to guide us out of the morass in which we find ourselves. So I'm eager to promote their ideas in any way I can.
So it sounds like you are somewhat optimistic, although it also seems like if the U.S. were to adopt the kind of policies you suggest, that number one status might no longer be there. And that seems to be what's driving the U.S. leaders, as far as I can tell, that idea of always being the dominant power.
Beard thought that any nation that aspires to be number one and aspires to lay down ground rules for other countries goes by the name of empire. And then he further observed, every empire in history, without exception, has always declined and is always disintegrated. Do we want to follow that path? Our goal should not be to be number one. That's what Rome aspired to be, and it achieved that goal, but in the end, it fell. Do we want to follow that path? Do we want to follow the path of the British Empire, which also fell? That shouldn't be our goal. The goal should be the promotion of democratic, egalitarian, economic, political, educational, cultural policies, and working with people and not trying to control them, which I think is an American problem today.
Did Beard pay much attention to the ideas of Arnold Toynbee?
That's an interesting question. Toynbee was writing his most important books at a time when Beard was beginning to lose ground in terms of his health, in terms of his energy and stamina. I've not read about his evaluation of Toynbee. I don't think he was a close student of Toynbee. There are other writers he paid much more attention to. I would say the chief of whom was Thurston Veblen, a great economist, the author of most famously, Absentee Ownership, his greatest book, 1923.
Not Theory of the Leisure Class? Or?
Well, that's an earlier one. And okay. That was probably his most popular book. But the one that moved Beard the most was Absentee Ownership. It was a later book. It really was the distillation of Veblen's ideas about what was wrong with the American economy and with the American political system. The American political system had failed as a democratic experiment because it was completely controlled by lobbies, PACs, and pressure groups, which were controlled by corporate financial interests. You don't have a democracy that way. We need one. And I think all those men, Veblen, of course, is from an earlier generation, died in 1929, Beard in 1948, but they all were united in thinking that the American democratic experiment had gone down the wrong path. It had gone down the path of oligarchy while calling itself a democracy.
Although isn't it true historically that the rich have tended to dominate representative democracies? I mean, has there really been an instance where they were unable to do that?
I suppose
if you have a strong labor movement, maybe not, but yeah.
No, I think you're right. I mean, there have been some very important books written on that very subject, many of them by the so-called Italian realist, Vilfredo Pareto, Roberto Michels, and others, that economic elites, no matter the system, always rise to the top in terms of influence and power. But there are degrees of that problem. And according to Veblen and Beard and William Appel Williams in Tragedy, The Tragedy of American Diplomacy, and more recently, Gabriel Kolko in The Politics of War, magnificent book, the problem of oligarchy has triumphed over the cause of democracy in America. This is the great battle to be fought to rescue our democracy from the stricken condition in which it now finds itself. And I think these historians, and in the case of Veblen, economists, have a great deal to teach us, a great deal of help to offer us in this battle that we need to be fighting as citizens in America.
That was Richard Drake, the author of Charles Austin Beard, The Return of the Master Historian of American Imperialism. He was speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg right here on KBOO News in Depth. Thanks for being with
us. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm.